Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognize, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. Being healthy and well is at the forefront of our minds, especially during this COVID era. So I'm delighted to say that for this season, I've teamed up with an Irish company that I really believe in. Taking Revive Active is one of the ways you can support your immune system this winter. The award-winning super supplement contains 26 active ingredients, including vitamin C, D and zinc, all in one handy daily sachet. And to celebrate our partnership, they're offering a 10% discount on all Revive Active products. Simply go to their website, you'll find the link in the show notes, and use the code SHEILA10. This week, I had a chat with singer-songwriter Janet Devlin.
I had a lightning moment, and now I get it, and it's insane. Like, I feel so lucky to have gotten to that point, and I feel obviously very lucky in the sense of, like, I wasn't successful in any of my attempts to take my own life, because I never would have been able to see what life is like on the other side of that. I would never have been able to put my hand on my heart and say, I love and care about myself and I deserve good things. I never would have had that. I would have died in the pain of existing. I would have thought living was burdensome. I would have thought that everyone hated me and therefore I deserved to die because I also hated myself. I never would have been able to see what it's like to watch the sunrise and be happy and just be content. And that, for me, is the biggest victory.
Janet is the youngest of four and grew up in Tyrone. And when she was 16, she appeared in reality talent show The X Factor. But behind her beautiful performances was a teenager who was really struggling. Now, before we get into the conversation, please check the show notes for any trigger warnings you might need to be aware of, as it's really important to prepare yourself in advance. This summer, she released her concept album, Confessional, and her fans are growing by the day. She's already clocked up a whopping 700,000 followers over the past few months alone on TikTok. Now, I'm not going to lie, this is a tough listen at times, but it's also really powerful and uplifting as well. Jana started self-harming when she was only 12. She was bankrupt at 18, and at the age of 20, she was an alcoholic. But now, at 25, she's in a good place in her life and she's opening up about her experiences. During our chat, she made me think. She made me think a lot, actually. She made me cry, but she also made me smile. So my advice is to stick with this episode. I really think this is a conversation worth hearing.
You've spoken very openly about struggles you've had in the past. So I wanted to kind of talk to you about when you first noticed that you had a tendency towards a negative self-image.
I genuinely, when I say this, like, I didn't know any different for my whole life. I don't ever remember thinking highly of myself or like having confidence or anything along those lines. I definitely always just had this voice in my head that was like, you're useless, you're not really worthwhile, like all that kind of stuff. From like a very young age, like I remember punching myself in the stomach when I was about 3 or 4 years old, because I was basically, I nearly got my cousins in trouble and I got very upset and like I just started beating myself up physically. So I've always possessed like a negative view of myself, essentially.
Where do you think that came from, or did it come from anywhere?
It didn't come from anywhere. Like, God, I'd love to be able to go, oh, this thing happened and the consequence thereof, I don't like myself. No. It just was always there. And like the problem with it always being there meant that I never questioned it. I never thought to be like, because if that's the brain you've always had and that's the internal monologue that you've always listened to, then you are convinced that that is how other people are living their lives. Like, I definitely feel like a lot of people at home, you know, do feel like that. They do have a very negative internal monologue, because anytime I would have been, I'd shown any sign of ego as a child, like it was, you know, you'd have a granny or somebody being like, don't let anybody know that you're good at that, you know, don't be bragging or something along those lines. So you're always, you know, your ego's always kept in check as at home. But unfortunately, like if you're keeping the ego in check of somebody who's already really insecure, it like it kind of keeps you in the negativity almost, I suppose. But yeah, so it's just always, it's always been in my internal wiring.
Yeah, and you're really making me think, because it is, hopefully, you know, there's a change happening, but it does seem to be part and parcel of an Irish mindset that, yeah, you don't want to get too big for your boots. So therefore, you never big yourself up. Or we tend to struggle with that because for fear of being seen that we love ourselves, but actually, truthfully,
you
don't love ourselves. Yeah, exactly.
It's hilarious.
Which is what we need to do. Yeah,
it's so funny, but I'm absolutely no way blaming anybody that like I grew up with or my family or anything like that, because my parents were so nice, were so chill, like but they were stereotypical Irish parents, you know, like there wasn't a lot of like physical contact, there wasn't a lot of I don't know, there was never an overuse of like, well done, there was never that here's a participation rosette for no reason. They were strict and firm, but in a good way, and like most parents as well, a bit stoic. But unfortunately, as I was an incredibly needy child who didn't know how to verbalize their wants and needs, essentially, I never asked for more, even though I wanted more. And it's a bit of a confusing dynamic that I'm only really getting to understand now this year, I suppose, which is the funniest part of it. But yeah, it's definitely bred into it. And in some ways it's good, but then if you're carrying that around and you can never ever say that you're worthwhile, or you can never say that you deserve good things, it becomes different. There's being humble, and then there's hating yourself, and it's a fine line, a very, very fine line, and it's worth taking some internal time to go, am I being humble, or am I literally not allowing myself to say well done to myself?
Yes. And you did say that, you know, you had a tendency to being maybe a little bit insecure, which I'm sure a lot of people can relate to who are listening. I can. Like, I was riddled with insecurities myself as a kid. So a lot of us, and particularly when we enter the teenage years, it's a confusing, weird time. And there's a lot happening, and a lot is, we're loaded with a lot of stuff that we have to contend with, all these physical changes and everything that's going on. So for you, you had this, you said from such an early age, at the age of 3, you had that memory. And then did it grow? Did it become a bigger thing then when you hit puberty?
Even before puberty, I think, I never, again, like I never questioned my mindset. But then when I hit 12, I started self-harming, and I feel like that's, like, now as an adult and I look back and I think, if I see a 12-year-old, I'm like, oh, Janet, you were a baby. you were a baby, like slicing into your own skin. That's, it's really sad, but it's just, it was a coping mechanism because from that early age, I was still predisposed to dissociative behaviours, which is again something I'm only learning now through years of therapy that I have, where basically my feelings just disconnect and go away on holiday because they're too much. I have too many feelings and my brain goes, hey, these are dangerous, like literally dangerous. Let's switch these off and you can just float. But unfortunately, the problem with that is I felt so little then that I was chasing a break from the numbness, and that break for me was, even though it's painful and you know, in my saner brain and mind now, it freaks me out and it scares me, the fact that I was capable of causing myself bodily harm. But you know, luckily I'm not living inside that insanity, but I can't judge my previous self for doing it, because I can't even imagine, you know, when you're young, we forget as adults that everything is a first time. It's your first heartbreak. It's your first time your friends fall out with you. Of course, the world feels like it's ending because you've no, like, you've no reference point to compare it to. So being 12 years old and not having my feelings and feeling complete, like only having numbness and just thinking that, you know, if I at least cut myself, at least pain is a feeling. And I know I'm a human being because I'll bleed, if you know what I mean. So I totally understand why I did it. It's just sad that I had to. But again, like, I was mentally ill. Like, I think that's another thing that people forget, you know, with mental illness. Like, you're quite far away from sane rational thought. You know, like, you and sane rational thought don't coexist together, and it's very easy for people who are living in sane rational thought to look at you with that mindset and go, that's crazy, and you're like, yes, because I didn't have sanity. So you're not wrong, but I didn't have that that
awareness.
Exactly.
And what did your folks, I mean, how did they respond to what was happening, or did they know?
No, nobody knew.
Nobody knew.
I was, and still am to this day, like, I'm a champion at hide and seek, you know what I mean? Like, I can hide absolutely anything and everything. Like, I had my drinking problem for years without anybody knowing, you know, so it's not new. But I think what people forget as well, like, I know a lot of people know younger people now who are going, that have mental illness or are struggling. Like, I didn't have the dialogue. I didn't have the understanding. I didn't know why I was doing what I was doing. So it would have actually just been a very infuriating process for my family to try and deal with. Because they'd be like, why are you doing this? And I wouldn't have had an answer. So I know it sounds weird to say, but I'm very glad I got to just go through that myself, I suppose, like, because there was nothing anybody could have done to make me stop, you know. And I feel like that's always the hardest thing with anybody in mental, not so much mental illness, but addiction, because self-harm is an addiction. It's like, it has to come from them. I mean, and when I did quit, I didn't know that I was only going to be quitting temporarily, because it came back when I was like 18 years old and I started self-harming again for about 2 years. So you know, it's like any addiction. It's
When you did it the first time, how did you feel?
Disappointed. I just remember being like, is this all it is to be human? Is it just to bleed? Wow, that's really not that impressive. But I definitely remember a hit of endorphins, and that's all I needed, really, was because it was, I felt something. I felt pain and I felt that wave of, because endorphins essentially, like, it's, you know, if you eat chocolate, you get endorphins. So what is it? It's like you feel good, even if it's temporary, you feel good. You feel like a little bit of warmth for a wee second. And that's what I had with self-harm.
You know, I think having this conversation and speaking so openly, which you've been doing, I know, for a really long time. And, you know, you do these YouTube clips and they're so bloody honest, I think you're going to really help a lot of people, not just those who maybe have thought the way you did or think the way you did, but also maybe family members that are trying to maybe understand what's going on with our sister or brother or whoever it is, and we're worried about them, to maybe, you know, make sense of it a bit more.
Yeah, that's been, you know what, it's actually the hardest part. Is like every day I get messages from people, but it's always the ones that upset me the most are the brothers, are the sisters, are the mums. And I've had people look me dead in the eye and go, what can I do? And yeah. I have to just openly say to them, like, there's nothing you can do. There is nothing you can do, unfortunately. You just have to wait for them to come to that realization. You can always point somebody in the right direction, and you can be there for them. But, like, you know, for love nor money, you can't get somebody on the straight and narrow through love alone. You know, it definitely is like somebody has to hit, like, an emotional rock bottom for themselves to kind of wake up. So that's the hardest part, you know, that there is nothing these people can do for them apart from just be there.
Yeah. What would you say, you know, to somebody who you know, is thinking very dark thoughts, and because you were there, you went through that, you were in a very dark place on a number of occasions where you didn't want to live anymore, you didn't want to be here anymore, and yet thankfully you woke up. You are here, and you're here to tell the tale, and not just to share your experience, but hopefully help others who will find themselves in a similar position.
Yeah, it's so hard to explain. Like I said earlier, like it depends obviously how far down that rabbit hole of darkness you go, but like you are far away from seeing rational thought. So when somebody says it gets better, you're like, sure, cool story. I definitely felt when I was in my darkest times, I felt very patronized towards. I felt like, you know, it's all good and well, like all these little happy posters, you know, the little cat hanging on the I always think of that little cat hanging on the washing line where it's like, hang in there. It's like, I get it, I really do. But it is a case of, you know, I wish I documented almost more of my sheer insanity and my real darkest period so that I could just play that to people. But obviously, like I mentioned it in the videos and stuff, like I have tried to take my life on numerous occasions, and I think for me the main thing is, like, I would just love to go back and just be like, there's gonna come a day when you're just gonna not be angry at the sun for rising. And it's so, and you're gonna forget about the pain in the best way possible, and you're gonna be able to get caught up in stupid things, and you're not gonna be constantly living in the fear of your own demise. And a big thing is also, like, when you're in that sadness and in that dark place, it's not comfortable, but it's familiar to a lot of people. And you get so used to it that you think that that is the way of living, whereas that's not true. It is just familiar. It's not comfortable. And if you can adapt to living in that level of discomfort, you can push through the boundary of having to work for maybe a year to rewire your thought processes and come out the other side and not live the way that you're like you were living. Because that's what I had to do. Like, I really had to, you know, the hardest thing, the biggest thing I work at now is being well, because I realized that everything else is a consequence, that it all falls in together when I'm well.
Yeah, and how do you do that?
Oh God, I have to, staying honest with myself. I go to a lot of therapy now. You know, I go once a week, and then if I really feel like I need it, I will book in for more. I go to meetings. I talk to people who are on my wavelength, but not in a negative way. I feel like that is a very common mistake. We find, you know, broken people kind of like flock together. But it's finding people who, yeah, maybe potentially were broken or are broken, but at least they're trying to get better. And I think that that's why, you know, say for an alcoholic, that's why the rooms work, because you're in a room full of people who are on a similar mindset of people that want to get better, that were, you know, living in a darkness. But truly it is just that, it's that overused phrase, and I hate it so much, but it's like, it gets better, but a lot of the times it gets worse before it gets better. But if you can, you've already survived 100% of your worst days at this point anyway. So it's just getting honest and reaching out, but like not necessarily in the way we think. Like, you don't have to reach out to anybody you don't want to. Go to your doctor, tell them what's wrong, get on that waiting list. This is the biggest one I hear from people, is, but the waiting list, like, it takes about a year, it takes 6 months. And I was like, and where are you going to be in a year or 6 months? Are you going to magically be happy? Or are you just still going to be waiting for help? Get on the waiting list. Do whatever you can. If you are in the financial position to get help, then do. And that is another thing that I hear a lot. It's like, I don't have the money for therapy. I'll be honest with you, my therapist cost me 60 quid. I have watched people say that they can't afford therapy but can afford nights out and can afford takeaways and can afford all of these lovely little luxuries, but they don't think about those. And it's like, if you just didn't go on your night out, you'd be able to go to therapy.
Yeah.
And I think as well,
reshaping your priorities.
Yeah, it's I think, you know, I'm luckily now in this blessed position where, like, I have to go to therapy even when I'm well, but I force myself to, so that when I'm not well, I've got, like, topped up on my wellness, you know, that I can,
I
have a fallback. But people just, I think, I forget, because I grew up with a mother who was very much like, as soon as somebody turns 16, they need a therapist.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She definitely firmly believes it. And I love that attitude. She understands that teenagers are going through it, you know? So she used to, you know, if I wanted help, I could get it, you know.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I didn't do it. Like, I did it through the school and things like that, because I think my school knew I was broken, so I got free therapy in school. But, like, she was always under the guise, like, you know, she helped other people. She paid for other people's therapy. My mum, like, she's a saint. I swear to God, she's an absolute saint. And she just kind of hit it home that even though I hadn't asked for it, she just let me know that there's no shame in going to therapy.
Yeah.
Because we have a very broken idea that to go to therapy you have to be broken, where it's like, no, essentially you just need to look at therapy as a third party in your life that has no bearings as to what you choose to do. Like, you know yourself, like, you can't go and talk to that person because they're going to tell you this because that's where their best interest lies. And life's a game of chess, whereas, you know, if you talk to a therapist, you're just talking to, like, an adjudicator who's got no, they just want your best interest, literally. And that's why I recommend it. So even just getting an outside perspective on things is useful. And also, like, I, as a person, hate taking up people's time. I feel very guilty for taking up people's time. Because that's just years of feeling like a burden, essentially. But I don't feel bad because I'm paying him.
Yeah.
So I'm like, it's your job to listen to me, dude. So I'm going to sit here and going to talk about my feelings.
You've used the word broken a few times, and I'm just curious to think, is that how you view yourself, or is that how you did view yourself once?
Oh, yeah. I used to see myself as very broken. I wouldn't see myself as broken now. It's kind of complicated, I suppose, because I still have mental illness. That just hasn't washed away because I got sober, or because I stopped acting out. Because I am aware that alcohol, self-harm, anorexia, all these things are a solution to the problem, and the problem is me and my thinking or my brain or whatever. But I don't live under this illusion that I'm a broken person, because I'm very, I'm fully functional. I'm out here being an adult, paying my bills, existing, you know, dating, all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
But it's definitely understanding that I'm prone to broken brain, is what I would say. Yeah, like my brain definitely isn't wired like everybody else's, and that's fine. But nobody's, there's like no bog standard brain we got going on here, but there's definitely a few wires in my head are in the wrong place, and I'm okay with that. And I just have to be aware that sometimes I can make decisions that aren't the best one because of how my coping mechanisms and my reward systems work in my brain. They are busted, I'll admit that. But it's just accepting that it's like, just because my brain does that or it doesn't necessarily have the best way of functioning sometimes doesn't mean that I'm a broken person. you know?
Yeah. But looking at you today, I mean, I saw you on telly when you appeared in X Factor back in the day, I think 9 years ago now. And, you know, you were on stage and you sang and you blew the judges away and you did incredibly well in that show. And I was just a fan, an X Factor fan, sitting on my couch at home watching it. I didn't think that 9 years down the line I'd be having this type of chat with that girl from the north, do you know? But thinking and looking at the amount that you have gone through over the past number of years, and obviously you spoke about it there, the issues you had didn't spring up from appearing on reality TV. They might have magnified, or things might have accelerated during the time that came with you know, becoming famous, but they were there, you know, before that and afterwards. But your body has healed itself incredibly well. Like, you have really put your body through an awful lot. This is not me trying to lecture you or say anything negative. What I'm trying to get at is your body's ability to heal is phenomenal, you know, in terms of the drinking, in terms of the self-harm and you not wanting to live in this world anymore. And look how your body has bounced back. Do you think your brain can bounce back? Your mind can heal from all of the, because, you know, you refer to brokenness and things maybe not working the way it should. Do you feel there's a possibility there that one day it will?
There are some long-lasting ramifications that I will have to carry around.
Okay.
Like, I abused benzodiazepines for about 7 years, which basically, I've done irreparable damage to my memory, and just maybe as the quickness to which I can process information, like, that's not going to be fixed, apparently. Like, I'm just going to have to come to terms with that. And that's all right. Like, it's fine. But I definitely believe in, like, just even little things. Like, my way of functioning and things have definitely got better. And I feel better as far as, it's kind of a hard one to explain. Like, the physical damages are different, definitely. Like, I still carry scars on myself, but I've decided to, you know, paint the walls a wee bit. I've got a few too many tattoos on my arm, to which my mum likes to complain about. But I'm like, what would you rather have, Patricia? Tattoos or, like, my scars on full show? That's basically me just having an excuse to get more tattoos. But that I'll carry around. And that's, you know, I know a lot of people look at that and it's sad, but, like, I'm not here to romanticize them either. Like, I hate when people are like, but your scars are beautiful. I'm like, they're not. What about an adolescent cutting into their skin is beautiful to you? It's disgusting. I don't need you to tell me that they're perfect or some weird notion. I don't want this. Calm down. Like, it doesn't have, not everything has to be romantic. But to me, it's just a reminder that I had a past that I once couldn't deal with. And luckily, I don't have to do that anymore.
You know, depending on why we have scars, some people have scars from operations or from, you know, giving birth or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So depending on the reason behind it, that the relationship with your scar will be dependent on so many different factors. So for you, it was a reminder of a really, really shit time in your life. So I can appreciate that it's not something that you want to be reminded of.
Yeah, think I'm just like on the metal grind about them. Like, I don't look, like, obviously I have to get changed every single day. And I, you know, half the time I don't notice them, you know. You notice them, like, maybe if you start dating somebody new. And, like, for me, my worst place of self-harm is on my thigh. And if somebody puts their hand there, like, if I've not dated them before, like, I'm like, oh God, they're going to feel the scars. And then I'm like, Janet, I'm pretty sure you offloaded all your emotional trauma on the first date. They know you're not exactly a basic case here. So, like, it is what it is, I suppose. Like, I don't feel shame when I see them. I don't feel bad when I see them. I don't, like, I feel, like, 90% of the time, I just feel nothing towards them, which I feel is the best place to be as far as carrying that with me. I think the only thing that, and the reason why I suppose I don't really walk around with them out all the time, you know, during the summer and stuff, I'd definitely wear shorts and stuff, but I feel like, you know, there maybe may come a time in my life where I have to explain them. And I feel like that's going to maybe test me a little bit. Like, if I ever had a child, which, you know, at 25, I don't really plan on doing. But, you know, who knows? The hormone monster could take over in a few years and we'll see. But, like, if a child, like, I remember being on the tube in London, and this is before I got my basically before I covered my arm in tattoos. I had a little girl look at my arm and tug on her mum and point, you know, and just be confused at the fact that my arms were sliced. And that breaks my heart. Like, you know, if I have to answer that question, like, mummy, why do you have marks on your arms, you know? I'm sure by then I will use my wisdom to come up with a nice, eloquent answer for my child. But you know, there is that wee sadness. And I think for me, it's sad, but I feel like it's just I want to ensure, and it's not even a parent's job. Like, no parent can ensure that their child will never endure that. And I think that that's the saddest part. Like, I could sit there and give them this beautiful, eloquent answer as to why they should never do it and why mummy was a fool. But they could, at 12 years old, turn around and do the same thing. And there's nothing I can do about that. And it's not my fault, you know. So it's that's the hard reality, I suppose, of the scars. But as far as other physical ramifications, like, I got my liver functions done. I got my kidneys checked, all that kind of stuff. Like, I think the worst thing is, like, I most definitely have a patchwork liver. It's fully functioning, one. It works fine. But there's a lot of scar tissue on it. But, like, as far as any proper, like, damage that would cause me any issues, no. So I got very, very lucky, because factually speaking, like, the worst kind of drinking you can do is the drinking I was doing, where it's like, maybe don't drink all week and then bang hard for 3 days. Because it's like you're actually better being the type of person who would have like a glass of wine every night, because your liver gets used to processing that. Whereas this
binge drinking,
it gives you that scar tissue on your liver, and that's where the damage is really getting done.
And when did that start?
The drinking?
Yeah.
You know, it's quite, like, it's a weird one for me. Like, I use alcohol unhealthily before TV sometimes, because I was dating a guy who was emotionally abusive, and it was not a good time. And he was upset that I was going to do TV. And he felt like I was...
By TV, you mean X Factor?
X Factor, yeah. He thought I was throwing my life away, and nobody was ever going to take me seriously. And, you know, the abuse got worse, obviously, the further into the relationship we got. But this is even before anything's aired. He's annoyed at me, and we used to, like, argue and then go to the off licence and get, like, vodka bottles each, and then we'd get drunk and then be best friends. So I that was the start of me using alcohol the wrong way. And, like, our relationship started because we both got drunk. But we both had crushes on each other for years, but we were both so shy that, like, alcohol gave me so much. Like, I got to meet him and to date him through being drunk. So, you know, with the
and that's not uncommon. Come on, like,
no,
from a lot of teenagers,
definitely.
That's not uncommon either. So
no, it's just like, know, that start of like solving problems with booze was not good. Like,
yeah.
But then, you know, I did TV. Our relationship got worse. He was still, you know, he was there. Like, I obviously hated myself when I did TV. I think that was very visibly apparent. But I would be sat there with all these negative thoughts rattling around my brain. And then I had a man, obviously, I loved and trusted, because our relationship wasn't always bad. But then I've got him in my ear going, you're not even that good. Your voice isn't even that special. I don't know why the general public like you so much. You're like, not even, like, this is ridiculous. So I just had him in my ear. And because I loved and trusted him, I thought the whole world was playing a big, horrible joke on me that I wasn't invited in on. Yes. And that was, you know, not good. Not his fault, you know. Not blaming him for any of my issues, obviously. But that's just something that, you know, was going on in my life at the time.
No, and because you had such a low opinion of yourself at the time, you then attracted somebody that reinforced that viewpoint.
Literally.
Rather than challenging it, yeah.
Yeah, instead of having somebody that's like, no, you're great, you're amazing, blah, blah, blah. Like, no, I didn't. Like, that's just not how it was. But then I did TV. I saw the good sides of alcohol, in the sense of, like, I went on tour, had a blast, could talk to people, could have a laugh, you know. But then it was really whenever I moved to Sheffield, and at this time, like, I couldn't, like, leave my house, you know. I hadn't turned 18 just yet, but I was about to. I couldn't leave the house because I'd get mobbed, and like, that is such a such a first world problem. So I can't go outside because like, people want my photo. But no, it was actually like dangerous.
Yeah,
I was kind of clutching at being normal. Like, all my friends were out partying and stuff, and then I was over here in a country where I knew nobody. I had no friends. I didn't relate to people my own age at this point. And I just, like, I loved my best friends, but they were all at home and they were all studying, and I was just in this flat on my own and I had no friends. And the fact was, I had so much, but I had so little at the same time. Like, I was able to go do these gigs with thousands of people and, like, you know, have everybody kind of like chanted your name, and that's amazing and all the rest of it. But then I'd get home, I'd drop my bags on the floor, and I'm in this apartment on my own. And I had no interpersonal relationships. And
you were 18. You were like, still a kid.
Yeah, I was like, at that point, I was like 17, 18, yeah. So, you know, it started off quite innocent, in the sense of, like, you know, I think main thing, I was obviously very lonely and quite sad, but still very grateful for the position that I had. But I would chase normality, in the sense of, you know, on a Friday night after I'd done a whole week in the studio, it's like, I'm going to have a bottle of wine. Yeah. Am I going to dance around in my bedroom in my knickers and sing some songs? Yeah. And that starts off nice and fun and all the rest of it, but it quickly becomes habitual. You start to drink more, your tolerance goes up, and it started infringing on my work life, where I'd be turned up to the studio and I'd be like, oh, one sec, guys, just got to go to the bathroom, and then go barf because I drank a whole bottle of Jack Daniels on my own that night. Like, you know, it took quite a long time. Like, I won't lie, maybe that's the Irish in me. Like, I could put away so much for so long that it took a while for it to really start hurting me.
Do people notice?
Nah, not for a long time.
Okay.
My blessing and my curse was the fact that you couldn't see it in my eyes.
Okay.
You know, some people get drunk and they get the glass eye. I didn't. I never got it. I looked fully awake. There was like no drunkenness in my eyeballs. So I could, you know, get along with my day, and nobody would know I'd even had a drink. It all quickly got even worse, though. Like, I worked really hard. You know, when I come off the show, I took every opportunity as a blessing, in the sense of, like, I was like, I can be tomorrow's news. I need to do every single gig. I need to get as much money as I can to put away to make this album, because I was making an album myself. And I really, really did. I worked really hard. And, you know, it's easy to work hard when the opportunities are there. I won't take that for granted. Then I woke up at 18 and I was bankrupt, because I'd signed a fake record deal, and I got all my money taken, and it was awful. I'd just gone on tour. The tour cost us like like 60 grand and like I owed that and I like this label didn't exist. And but it wasn't just me, because obviously it was so easy for me to be like, oh, I was young, I was naive. But like people, like there was American producers who've won Grammys that got caught up in it. Like I don't want to name names, but that and like big producers and other artists, like this guy is like proper catch me if you can. Like he managed to wrangle in so many people. He's wanted by the FBI in 18 different countries. Like
he's still wanted.
Yeah. And I've quit that search. Like I don't even need to get revenge, you know, because success is the best form of revenge. You know, I worked for years till I got to the point where I think it was only 2 years ago where I reached zero, where I'd paid off all the debt. And, you know, that was like obviously hard at the time because I literally just woke up at 18 and I was like, oh, all my money's gone. Jeez. I can't make this album. What the frick? This is awful. So like that was the start of an even darker period in my life, because I'd trusted people blindly, like as you do as a young person. You know, you haven't learned your lesson yet that you can't trust people. But I needed that lesson. Everybody in the music industry has a teaching moment like that at some point. Everybody gets, you know, screwed over at one point. It's inevitable, right? And to this day, I'm so happy it happened to me when I was 18, because the older you get, the harder it is to recover. Like if that happened to me tomorrow, oh my God, I don't know. Like I feel like at least at 18, like I was still young and stupid enough to kind of keep going. I did. There was so many hard times. Like I remember I couldn't tell anybody that this fraud had happened, right? And I only ever opened up about it this year. But nobody knew I had lost six figures. Nobody knew I woke up and had no money, you know? But there was definitely, I remember having this day where I did loads of press and, you know, it all looks good. Like at the time, you know, people sending you free clothes, but that was great because I didn't have the money for clothes. I was living on £25 a day and... or £25 a week, not £25 a day, I wish. £25 a week I was living on. And I was in London, did all my interviews. And because I'd used my money to get into central London and like had to eat lunch and stuff, my mummy had booked me a flight home. And I'd just gone back to one of my manager's house. And it was like, all right, cool. It's like 4 o'clock. I can go to the airport now. So I go to get on the train and I put my card in the machine and it's like insufficient funds. And I'm like, I don't even have enough money to get the train to the airport. Yeah. And I had to walk back and like he had to give me the money for the train. And it was just this living this big lie, essentially, you know, where like on the outside, I looked like I was doing really good. Like I just put a record out.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I was doing all this press, and it was good press and stuff, but I'm just sat there like, I have... no money. Wow. I remember not eating dinner a lot. I remember at the time I smoked. Now that sounds hilarious because like you don't have money, but it was like, oh, well, if I smoke, though, I don't need as much food. So I would smoke instead of eating. But I know this sounds really weird and it was awful at the time. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, that pushed me further and further into a breakdown. But the fact of the matter is, like, if that didn't happen to me, I would have lived my whole life thinking the only reason people... I've been given my whole career. Because I did TV, I got given everything on a gold plate, and I've not had to work a day in my life, and I'm an imposter and I'm a fraud. And no, like, at least I know in my head I had to work really feckin' hard for years. Yeah. For absolutely years. One, to be taken at all seriously in the industry, and two, to get out of the debt that somebody had caused me. And, you know, I feel like at this point now, I'm like, I've done enough toilet tours. I've existed on so little that, like, I'm allowed to say that I've earned my place in the industry.
Jesus, you're one bloody strong woman. I tell you, I had no idea, actually, about that. I had no idea that at 18 that had happened to you on top of everything else you'd been through. Do you think it's unfair that people have this... they kind of poo-poo, you know, the stars that come from reality TV shows. Mm-hmm. And obviously we know that some of them are absolutely massive, not necessarily those who win, but, like, you know, One Direction being probably the biggest example of it. Like, they came second and they became a global phenomenon. Mm. But is it unfair? Because you still have to work beckin' hard.
It's kind of different now. Like, I think virality, like, say, like, videos going viral and all that kind of stuff is the new TV. And yeah. I feel like people look at those people and go, oh, your video went viral. And it's like, yeah, but they still have to maintain that. They still have to, like, maintain that level of output and all that kind of stuff. Like, yeah, like, it's so hard because I feel like, you know, you've got to use nuance when it comes to TV talent shows. Like, some people do go on those shows just to be famous. Some people go on those shows to get a platform. It's all very different. And obviously, like, different types of shows breed different types of people and things. But I was a teenage music purist. So I get where people are coming from when they're like, oh my God. Like, I was so much of a purist that even on X Factor, when I was given a Nirvana song to sing, because, like, Courtney Love had given me the rights, she was like, no, I want you to sing a Nirvana song. I said no, because I was like, no, Kurt will be rolling in his grave, I don't want to.
Actually, I really want to, I'm glad you brought this up, because that was one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because I remember hearing this at the time. Mm-hmm. The whole Courtney Love thing and the link between Kurt with the whole Devlin thing. So yeah. can we go there?
Yeah, I mean, you know as much as I do at this point. Like, basically, now this is what I've been told. Devlin married into Cobain, and Cobain changed their surname from A-N-E to A-I-N when they got to America, and that's how that happened. Now, I haven't a clue. And
he was your cousin.
Aye, so apparently so. which I don't even want to know. Even during X Factor, I had a Nirvana poster up in my bedroom. Like, I was a massive fan. And, like, you know, I if I look it up and I find out we're not, very sad. So I'm just like, I'll let that be. Just kind of exist and do its own thing. But, yeah, that was the thing that happened. But it was just funny because I was such a hipster. I was such a hipster. And I was, like, on the most uncool TV show ever, and I was still like, I don't know, it was a funny dynamic. But
what was it to do with your own feelings of unworthiness at the time, that, you know, because you idolized Nirvana? I can't do the song justice. What the program playing in your mind?
That, and also, like, I already got so much hate. I was like, I don't want the Nirvana. Like, the Nirvana fans are very aggressive. Like, no offense. Like, I was one. You know what I mean? I still am one. But, like, teenage Nirvana fans are very loud and proud. And, like, I didn't want to, like, do a song and then have to wake up and just read the bullcrap of, like, oh my God, she butchered Nirvana. I'm like, I get it. I know I did. Okay? I know I sucked. And I know I ruined your favorite song. Cool story, bro. Join the line. Everyone hates me. Cool. My problem was, I think, more so during X Factor, was I agreed with all the haters, and I was like, we'd be good friends, though, you know? I know you hate me, but, like, we get on, because I hate me too. Which
was
is
it,
so
was it safer for you to kind of come back at them with this kind of agreeance, or this, I'm not going to argue with you, because actually, and also sometimes being self-deprecating and putting yourself down first before anyone else does gives you a certain level of power or control, not even power, but just a little bit of control over a crap situation.
Yeah, I honestly just never really responded to it. Just because I was like, it's the same annoyance of like, you know, when you give someone a compliment and then they are like, oh, well, no, it's actually very annoying. And I learned that myself because I was that person. I was like, oh my God, no, like this, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, just shut up and take the compliment, Janet. It's the same with hate. It was like, shut up and just take the hate. Don't say anything. Just accept it, you know? Because like, you're not going to win either, eh? You know? So I agreed with them. But also I've turned it into like my biggest blessing. Because I did hate myself so much, and because all of that, you know, when somebody gives me a hate comment now, I'm like, that's a wild weak insult you got there, mate. Like, nothing you say is as bad as what I've ever said to myself in my head. So congrats. That insult was just awful. Like, you know, I could give you a 10-page spread on my deep-rooted insecurities and you've hit none of them. So cool.
So I'm thinking about you at 18 on your own, going through the shitstorm that it was being bankrupt, and having to deal with that, and you know, your mom booking the flight home and getting home. I don't think anyone would have been surprised if they heard what you'd been through if you just decided to say, okay, I am done. I'm done with this. I'm just gonna come home, chill out here for a while, and then I'm gonna reshape what I do and go from there. But you didn't. You didn't give in.
No, I didn't. And it's, do you know what? It was actually a very unhealthy obsession that I had for some, like, this is why I say I'm so glad it happened to me then and not now. Like, I was so mentally ill that I thought, like, if I don't do music, I have to die. Which is terrifying. Like, I carried that with me for so many years. Like, if I wasn't doing music, then my life is pointless and I shouldn't live. And then when I went to rehab and I realized that that was this mindset I was living under, I was like, no. Like, you can do music. You don't have to die for it, dude. Like, if you wanted to quit tomorrow and you wanted to go work in Tesco's, go work in Tesco's. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, if I felt passionate about making coffee and I wanted to be a barista, you're sure as hell right I'd go and be a barista. Like, I don't care what other people's opinions are. So I was like, Janet, it's okay. You don't have to die for this. And from that moment, I've had much more of a healthy approach to myself in the music industry, and it's been much easier. But luckily, oddly enough, at the time I had that mentality of like, I have to do this. So basically I worked like a dog for years, just like, also because like the people I was working with at the time, now the people know, like my management is still the same. They inherited me when I had nothing. Like, I'd just been scammed, they'd been dragged into that scam, and we worked really hard together to get out of it. And, you know, now we're in this lovely, blessed place where we can just make music. And I'm every day grateful for that. And I don't take it for granted, I suppose, now. But, like, definitely I wouldn't have been able to survive that because I'm mentally well now. I'd have been like, you should probably not. It's like, you know, you're very mentally broken. You should probably, like, take a gap year. Do something that's not music. No, I was so gung-ho and so dedicated, but in an ill way, that I lasted it out and then I stuck it out. And, you know, I still work really hard now. I still fully immerse myself in my job. But, you know, I'm very... I've got a healthy relationship. Like, I know that I can walk away, but I don't want to because I tried quitting once and I lasted 3 days. And by day two, I had already planned out who I was going to make another record with and who I was going to work with. And I was like, I'm going to move home and sure, such and such plays guitar and we could start a band. And I'm like, okay. But I kind of needed to quit in those 3 days for me to go, dude, like, music is actually your true love and it is the thing that gets you out of bed. And, it sounds really sad, but it is like my thing. Like, it's,
it doesn't sound sad at all. It's it's fundamental to who you are.
Yeah, it's because I'm really bad sometimes at communicating my feelings as well. Like, I don't have that same level of struggle when it comes to music. Like, I can sit in a room and write a song and then by, like, just almost, like, black out. It's really weird. I black out and then I'm kind of like, oh, we've been really sad and we didn't realise it. Because we've just written down all of the emotions that we didn't process, but this is what's been going on lately, you know?
And has this been a helpful process, you know, the writing, not just the music, but the accompanying book, the project that is, you know, your confessional?
It was very hard. The book, like the album was so fun because it was just this big concept and I could write a million layers of metaphors. And as somebody that just loves writing, like even if it's not music, like I just like writing words, you know, it was such a fun experience. But when I actually had to sit down and really look at what I'd done in my life and the bad things that I'd done, and then I think it was even harder in some ways to write down the things that other people had done to me, you know, like the sexual assault or like the fraud or whatever, was very hard because I like to blame myself for everything. And I hate that somebody else can come into my life and take credit for my bad brain. Like, how dare you? So that was actually quite difficult. And obviously, the book's like not all bad. Like, there are happy stuff that happens as well. And it's kind of like an anti-self-help book. It's like you get to see all the horrible situations I put myself in. But again, it's been helpful for like parents and friends of people with mental illness because they can see, because I'm able to now that I'm out the other side, I can write down my justifications as to why I did things and what my rationale was and my, you know, not so clear thought processes, like, or not healthy thought processes, basically. But for me, the biggest thing was, like, I do pride myself in honesty, and I was in my personal life living a very honest life. And I obviously understand that nobody deserves, like, not that nobody deserves, like, nobody has, I don't have to be vulnerable for anyone, you know, like, no one needs that. Like, I owe nobody that, you know. But for me, I feel happiest when I'm honest, because lies are a lot of work. And I don't have the memory for it, thanks to the benzos. So for me, the only way I can live my life is just through honesty. And, you know, from doing TV at 16, like, I am used to people knowing about my life, you know?
Yeah.
I'm used to telling people what's going on in my life. Like, that exposure to honesty on a public level is my normal. It's normal everyday life for me. So the hardest part was living in the lies, or like, not so much lies, but like living not telling my truth.
So and the secrecy of it, because you did say before, like, that you were really good at keeping things secret.
Mm-hmm. So when I started getting well, you know, when I was 20, I really just wanted to tell my story from the rooftops, in the sense of like, oh my God, it can get better. Obviously I didn't, because I knew as well, like, I had to really put the work in to really get better and to really understand myself and to get to a point where I knew it was safe to be open. Because now, like, if somebody comes for me in my YouTube comments where they're like, you were never really an alcoholic, I'm like, I am so glad you see the well version of me so clearly that you can't imagine me being unwell. And that's a weird compliment. But like, it's very hard to be on that thought process if you're living in illness, or if you're not well enough, or you're not, like, it's not recovered enough, but, you know, you don't have enough distance from the past or the time you were living in. So for me this year, since talking about my story, has honestly been my best year. For just being myself and not having to think about something before I post it, or you know, making videos, which, you know, say like the TikToks, where I can openly talk about my mental illness and joke about it, because like, that's my coping mechanism, and I find those kind of jokes funny.
Yeah. No, I can tell. I was actually going to bring it up, but it's so obvious that, you know, humor is useful, and I get it. I'm very similar. I think a lot of us are, probably very Irish thing as well. You know, dealing with really dark topics with humour?
I feel like it's the first thing I learned when I got sober was I went to my first meeting and these girls were like laughing at something that I was living in. And obviously when you're living in it, it's so dark, it's so real, it's so raw. And they're just like laughing at theirs. And you're like, I want that. I want to be able to do that. And obviously for a very long time, you can't make those jokes publicly. Because like if I was to crack like an alcoholic joke in front of my mum 2 days after I got sober, she'd be like, here, you put me through hell and back. Don't you fucking dare laugh about that in my face. You know, it's like it gave me a safe space to laugh about that kind of stuff. And now that, you know, I'm far enough away from that, I feel like I have the right to. And obviously there are times where people come at me and they say, like, how dare you, you know, joke about this and joke about that. It's very real. It's very this. And I'm like, I know because I lived it. And there's also a lot of people in my shoes now where for years we've been eating ourselves up at the severity of the situations we put ourselves in. Like, give us a break, you know. We're allowed to laugh at it. It's my pain, it's my trauma. I can laugh in the face of it, you know. But I also understand that, you know, from those comments, I respect when somebody is in it and when they are suffering through something that I'm joking about, that it is painful. It's not nice seeing somebody else just laugh about it. But I can't make them see my side of the fence because they're, you know, maybe in the darker side, you know, and like I just can't take it personally, you know.
Yeah. And speaking of taking it personally, now when you read, if you get negative comments, and unfortunately when you're in the public eye, there's always going to be good commentary and not so good commentary. But before you may have embraced the negativity and kind of said, well, yeah, no, I feel this about myself anyway. So, you know, you're not saying anything new. How do you feel about it now? What happens if you get a shitty comment?
So it all very much depends. So I do get lots of shitty comments. It's just an inevitability. Like, it's that is something you sign up for. I do love people when they're like, I want to do it, but like I couldn't handle the hate. I'm like, well, then don't do it because it's inevitable. But I think at the weekend, I was very hormonal and I took everything to heart. And, you know, I just was in that space like nobody could really talk to me, right? And that's fine. I'm all right with that. I'm like, this is the mood we're in. This is our current state. I tried getting some work done. So I sat down. I was ready to answer some comments because I just dropped the EP on like the Friday. So I wanted to like tell people thank you. And then obviously, you know, with the love, you get the hate. And I was reading a few things and I was like, like ready to type out these responses. And I was like, hold on a second. Janet, are you taking this to heart? Yes. Please close your computer and step away from the vehicle, ma'am. You know, once my guard's down, it's really like a case of if I'm emotionally vulnerable, you know, I'll take in the good and I'll take in the bad. I don't get that choice of filtration. So for me, the safest thing to do is just to log out that day. And those days are very rare, but I'm at that point now where I can see it and I can step away. Most days, like anything, it's like compliments I don't really take and I don't take hit. And I feel like that's just where I kind of live in that existence of like, because I believe in myself and because I do love myself now. Like, I don't seek external validation. Like, I obviously appreciate a compliment as much as the next person, but I don't really feel like it penetrates the surface. Like, I don't really take it to heart, but I don't need to because I believe in myself. But it means then I don't take in the hate. So this middle ground is the safest place for me to be in because I can look at hate and normally laugh at it and sometimes monetize off it if I do a YouTube video about it. So, you know, monetize off the hatred, but it's the best place for me to be. So I have learned to be my biggest cheerleader so that I don't take any of the bad things to heart, but I don't also take the good things to heart because also I do have a fear. I'm Irish, like I will have a fear of being an egotist, so I do try and stay away from both.
I know you can't see me now, but I'm actually listening to you here with a huge smile on my face because I just absolutely love, and I mean love, what you've just said, because it's something that I have been talking about for years. And I think when you get to that place, and wherever and whenever that is for any of us, that we can comfortably get to that place, it's not always easy. But when we can't be, you know, knocked off balance by a shit comment or elevated by the compliment, we know we're doing something right. Yeah. Because oftentimes, yeah, we can feel this glow of warmth of I'm loved, I'm wanted, I'm liked. And, you know, a lot of it, we're looking for this validation online or whatever it is. And it means nothing, because you have to feel it from inside. Same goes for the negativity. And if you can take both the compliment and the insult with the same level of reverence, which is none at all, really, you've got it. You're there. So I'm just smiling listening to you, because we've been talking now for whatever, the guts of an hour. And I've heard so much. And I know you've probably only scratched the surface with me and those listening to this chat. But you've been through so bloody much. But look where you're at now. To say that, it's just like, wow, you're in a really good place.
Yeah, it's taken a very long time. And for me, what's funny, and I suppose what everybody's journey is different, like, you know, to have, you know, got sober at 20, some people might imagine that, like, I developed self-love a year later or even 2 years later. And it wasn't even the case. Like, at the start of January 2019, when I went to rehab, finally, after like a wee mini relapse, but it was what that symbolized for me. Like, I went and finally got better. And in that, like, I couldn't even say I'm worthwhile. I couldn't say I'm worth it. I couldn't say I loved myself. And I was like, oh my God, like, these words can't even leave my mouth. And here I am now. That was January 2019. And here I am, just being able to go, like, I love myself, I'm worthwhile. Like, these are obvious and fundamentals. But, like, it took, like, a good solid year of that to get better. But, like, this is what I'm saying. I had an accelerated, like, year and a half of just, like, I finally got the message. I finally, it's the penny dropped, you know, in a good way. But it took, you know, you'd think that that would happen earlier or sooner. But, like, that's just proof of everybody's so different. Like, I had a lightning moment. And now I get it. And it's insane. Like, I feel so, like, lucky to have gotten to that point. And I feel obviously very lucky in the sense of, like, I wasn't successful in any of my attempts to take my own life, because I never would have been able to see what life is like on the other side of that. I would never have been able to put my hand on my heart and say, I love and care about myself and I deserve good things. I never would have had that. I would have died in the pain of existing. I would have thought living was burdensome. I would have thought that everyone hated me and therefore I deserved to die because I also hated myself. I never would have been able to see what it's like to watch the sunrise and be happy and just be content. And that for me is the biggest victory. And it is proof of, like, sticking it out, because I stuck it out for 5 years and I still didn't feel like I was worthwhile. But then just magically over, like, 8 months, 9 months, a year, the penny dropped. And now I'm able to just sit here and be like, wow, I can be okay. And that life is really, really good, even when it sucks. Because life is never easy, but the human condition of always putting too much on our plate or whatever, like, at least I know that I've chosen that, you know. And it's just a simple gratitude for existing, and I'm just glad that I didn't die in that pain. I'm glad that I got to see that life is actually worthwhile and that people aren't bullshitting and they mean it when they say it, and it's not just lies that they tell themselves, you know. And that, like, I hopefully will live a very long and boring life, and I'll never have to write a book like my confessional, like, that all my darkness is in those pages and I can now move on and live a dull life, essentially.
I get what you're saying. I get what you're saying. God, that's so powerful. And I'm so glad. And I think anyone listening to this would be so bloody glad that that you're here. And you're able to share your insights. And as you said, those dark times, for them to be behind you. Not that we never know what life is going to throw at us, and challenge can come in different forms. But my goodness, you've tested yourself. And I'm sure you learned a lot about the person you are and how worthy you are of your place in the world and what a talent you are. And you're able to share that with us. Because there will be people listening who are in it, who are really in it right now.
That's a big thing as well. Like, getting better is all great and all well, whatever, but, like, it's so easy to forget that people are still in it. People do, they are in that pain that I was living in. And it's one of those cases where I wish I could just grab them by the shoulders and be like, oh my God, it gets better. Please just hang in there. It breaks my heart. It really, really does. And I, like I said, when I think back to my own experience, there's nothing anybody can say that's going to make you believe that. But at least stick around to get to the point where you can look back and be like, Jesus Christ, I took things well seriously, didn't I? And I put myself through hell. Or, you know, some people are like, I was lucky in the sense of I put myself through hell, like for whatever reason, you know, my lack of self-confidence and all that kind of stuff. But some people get dealt a very unlucky hand, and it is okay to not be okay with the fact that the universe was not kind to you. But as somebody who does have a slight belief in God, like I do believe that, you know, the good Lord never gives us more than what we can handle.
Yeah.
And, you know, even when you do feel like life is throwing a lot at you, that you can deal with it, and there's always a lesson in it somewhere. And, you know, it's perseverance is key. You know, sometimes you just got to get up, do the things you have to do. And as long as you get into bed, even if it means, for me, when I got sober, like I would be in bed sometimes at 7 o'clock at night, and it's like, why were you in bed at 7 o'clock at night? And it's like, this is the only way I can guarantee that I won't put a drug or a drop in me. Like, I'm going to bed so I'm safe. Like, sometimes it is just that. But, you know, I feel for people who have been dealt the unlucky cards, because, you know, I shuffled my own deck and I made my cards bad because I did that. I can't even imagine the struggle of people, you know, who've been given it, you know. And it's the same. It's the same outcome. It's the same perseverance. It's the same just keeping on.
Yeah. Did your faith, your belief in God, give you strength or give you comfort in times when
you
felt like you needed? No.
No. Yeah. I didn't believe in God when I was going through my pain. I really, really didn't. And sometimes I do question God's belief. Like, I understand why I, as an addict, have to have a God, because if I don't have a God, then I think I am God and I'm the centre of my own universe. And that's why I need a God, because I need to be held accountable for my actions. You know, over time, it doesn't necessarily feel like that God I was raised with or anything like that. I definitely just believe in it. I think it sounds really cheesy, but I believe in the fact that we're all connected somehow, be it even if it's just on this earthly plane, there is still something that connects us all. And for me, the biggest importance, it sounds so cheesy, but it's love. Like, when we give love, be it received or not, that is the purest way and the best way we can live our lives. And, you know, so I believe in something with a capital S. I don't know what it is, but if that belief in something keeps me on the straight and narrow, I will take it. Also, I used to have sleep paralysis, where I like literally could see demons and stuff, and it was really dark and it was really scary, and I thought I was going to get murdered. This is how I learned I had a faith. It was I thought I was going to die because I'd never had sleep paralysis before. And it's obviously really scary and it's very real and you feel like you are actually going to die. And I noticed that, like, the first thing I did was, you know, say my Hail Marys.
Yeah, okay.
You know, screaming for that, like, repentance or whatever. Like, and I was like, oh, see, joke's on you. You do believe in God. So I was like, okay, that's fine. I'll take that on board. And since then, you know, since being out of the darks of despair or whatever, like, I can appreciate that I do have a faith. But faith definitely wasn't getting me through the dark times, unfortunately. I think you need to have faith in yourself, which is the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
That's just so annoying about this whole thing, is like, you finally have to reach that breaking point where you're like, I've existed in so much pain and suffering, and think of all the energy I'm putting into my pain and suffering. Like, what if I just, for once in my life, for the first time ever, just took some, even a quarter, 0.01% of that energy and put it into loving myself? What happens? And it's like, I've never done that before. so therefore it's scary, so therefore it's unknown, so therefore I don't want to. But if you do, because that was me on my first day of getting sober, was like, right, just even a minuscule amount of energy put into not hating ourselves and working on loving ourselves. Like, can we do that? And at that point, I was so broken and I was so tired. I was like, sure, what's there to lose? Because you do get to that point where you're like, what is there to lose? Nothing. Right, fine. I love myself. Yeah. What's the worst thing that could happen? The worst thing that happens was I got better. And it's like, oh, how funny that. But it's that fear of the unknown. It's the fear of the unknown. Like, if you've gone your whole life, like somebody like myself, like when I say I was born with that wrongly wired brain, and I always thought that self-hatred was the norm, and that's just how my programming was. Like, it does take years of deprogramming. It takes a long time to really sit there and question every thought you have and why you have that thought, and is that a healthy thought, and is that coming from a dark negative place? And yeah, it is very self-indulgent, and yes, it is very boring, and yes, it's very tiresome. But I'd spent so long accidentally and inadvertently being self-absorbed, tiresome and burdensome through self-hatred, because, like, you know, what we don't understand is the way we treat ourselves, whether we want to realize it or not, is how we treat other people. So if we are tearing ourselves apart, if we're breaking ourselves down, even if we are an addict or an alcoholic or in these forms of self-harm through people-pleasing, we are still inadvertently hurting the people we love and we care about, because we can't look after ourselves. So the least selfish, most selfish thing you can do when you're broken is actually finally pulling up your socks and getting better.
Yes.
Because eventually then people don't have to worry about you, and you can actually look after yourself. And it just is like, it's so silly, but it's so true. Like, it, unless you really do start looking after yourself, like, you are hurting those around you. You know, we forget that because we're like, how dare you take on my pain? This is my pain, my suffering, you selfish person. Like, it's mine. And it's like, well, they love you. And that for me was my biggest annoyance. Like, I tried pushing my friends, my family, my team, everybody away from me because I didn't love myself. So how very dare they love me? How, like, go away, get out of my life. Can't you just leave me alone to self-destruct? Like, what is the big deal? And I just couldn't understand that, because I couldn't love myself, that other people could. But then through, you know, having to do that really boring self-work and self-care and all that stuff that sounds so cheesy and so fake and so false. But when we
it doesn't sound cheesy. I don't think it does. Well, see,
when I was ill and people be like, oh my God, just practice some self-care. You're like, shut up. Oh my God.
Okay.
It was like awful. Like, stop it. Stop patronizing me. But like, yourself for 5 minutes, you know, just like buy into it and just treat, like, I have to treat myself like a weigh-in sometimes. Like, I have to treat myself like a child. Because, like, whether or not, like, when I went to rehab and people were like, they're treating us like children. I'm like, yeah, because what have we been acting like? Children. We're crying out for a substance, dude. Like, you are a child. Accept it. So, yeah, you can tell somebody broke me in rehab when I had to give them that chat. But it finally made sense to them. It's like, yeah, for the first time in your life, just do what you're told. Just do it. Where's the harm in it? So that's kind of what I did in AA and all that kind of stuff. I just did what I was suggested to do. I followed in the footsteps of people, and I patronized myself enough into looking after myself, basically.
Well, all the things you did clearly have worked, because they're where you're at right now, and you're absolutely, it's refreshing to listen to you. And I've just taken so much from hearing your views on things. And I think it's going to be really helpful to people, depending on where they're at, what their own circumstance is, whoever is kind of drawn to listen to this conversation. I hope they'll take some really important lessons from it. And if you're really in it right now, to know that you may not believe it or feel it or know it right now, but there is always light, and you're an example of it.
Yeah, but also I just have to feel like I give a disclaimer at the end of every conversation like this. I still have no idea what I'm doing.
Look, none of us do.
I always find that so funny. Like, when people look to me for advice, I'm like, I'm sorry. Have you forgotten that I am mentally ill? Don't seek advice from me. But all I can
I would not call you mentally ill. You may have mental
illness
challenges, but that doesn't mean you're ill. That's my take on it.
Yeah, but I always feel like it's a necessary point to just be like,
sure.
All I can do, because I can't help people, but all I can do is like show people what I've went through, what I've been through, and then just go like, I'm still kicking.
But you are helping people just by being you, just by being real, just by being honest, just by telling it as it is. That's hugely helpful, because that empowers somebody else to do the same, because being so open and honest doesn't come easy to everybody. Being that vulnerable is sometimes the most alien place to be.
Oh, absolutely. But I can't sit and claim either that I'm like perfect, because I'm so good, right, at like talking about my vulnerabilities publicly on a public platform, all that kind of stuff. But like, say for example, I'm dating somebody.
Yeah.
Oh my God, ask for help. I will not ask for help. What do you mean express my vulnerabilities? No, I am fine. I do not need you. And it's like, I still have work today. I'm very aware of that. And like, I'll continue to work on those kinds of things. But like, that is a very far cry, yeah, from my past. But it's I'm in no way a living, image of what people maybe should always look up to or something like that. All I can say is like, honesty breeds honesty, and I hope that by me talking about my bull crap that somebody else can open up about theirs, because it's not that bad. Like, it's not, it's scary, like we make it out to be much worse than what it is. And I get that for a lot of people, they've been holding on to their secrets for their whole life, and there's stuff that they've done or stuff that they've felt that they've never been able to share. But I can assure them, even though I'm young or whatever, like, I understand that like nobody has to listen to me. Like, I'm not saying that they should, but I'm saying that when it's out there and when you've told anybody, at least one person, it feels a million times better. You're not owned by it. You don't live with that weight on your chest anymore. So I can highly just recommend, you know, for me, I always say it, like, I recommend therapy. Get yourself that third party in your life that you can just open up with and tell them the things that are actually going on.
For people listening who, are a fan of yours, or people who are maybe hearing about you for the first time, or maybe people who followed you when you're on X Factor, because I know you mentioned TikTok as well. You're huge on TikTok. But where would the best place be for people to go to find you, your music, what you're all about?
So it's definitely weird. Now I exist kind of on two sides of the internet. I post videos about myself and my life and all that kind of stuff. So I do that, but I also do music, you know. I like, that is obviously the thing that gets me out of bed. But basically, if social media exists, I'm on it. But like, my main ones are like the YouTube channel. So I post on there pretty regularly, usually about two videos a week. I do have a TikTok, which is my most followed social media.
How many followers do you have on it?
Like 700,000.
What?
I know, and all I do is chat nonsense.
So come here now, Janet. When this conversation goes live, do not TikTok and tell them to listen.
So there's TikTok, there's Instagram, there's Twitter, there's YouTube, there's my own website. There's, you know, if you're into the music side of things, which is, you know, if you're into it, that's awesome. But like, it exists on all platforms that put the music out. So, you know, you got your Spotify, your Apple Music, your iTunes, everything. I still make physical music, surprising. So I have like a wee store on my website and all that kind of stuff. So,
Janet, thank you so much. This conversation has been so much, to be honest. I have you've made me smile, you've made me cry, you've made me think, you've made me feel incredibly grateful to you and for my own life. And I think that's the message, really, is to just find gratitude wherever you can find it. And again, you know, I know there's a fear sometimes that can sound cheesy, but I just think it's truthful. I think even in times of real difficulty, there's always something to be grateful for, even if it's something tiny, like, you know, the socks I'm wearing today. But there's always something. And if you can zone in on that more and more, hopefully that might be just the thing, the anchor that keeps you hooked in to get you over a difficult time. And maybe not, you know. And
honestly,
there are times,
no, sometimes it is the dumb stuff that keeps you well. Like, whenever I wanted to drink again during lockdown, I was saying to my therapist, I was like, the only thing that's keeping me away from a drink is the fact I've got new carpet, Mark. And I know I'd ruin it if I had a drink. There'd be red wine everywhere. So sometimes it is the silly stuff, the small things that, you know, can help. Like, yeah. Obviously, I had loads to be grateful for. I just put out an album, just put out a book. But for me, it was the feckin' carpet. I was like, I don't want to ruin it.
Hey, and if that is the thing that works,
exactly.
Zone in on the carpet. Why not? you're a breath fresh air. Thank you so much. I look forward to us meeting in person someday.
Oh my God, absolutely.
As you can tell, I was incredibly impressed by Janet. And for more on her, go to our website, janetdevlin.com. And if you or someone you know is struggling right now, please know that there is help available. Reach out to the likes of Pieta House or the Samaritans. Their details are in the show notes. And as a gesture of gratitude to Janet, I've made a small donation to Pieta House. Please do let me know what you think of this conversation by leaving a comment or a rating. And if you haven't already subscribed to this podcast, why not click the follow button now? I'd be so grateful. This episode of Ready to Be Real Conversations was brought to you in partnership with Revive Active, your daily super supplement made here in Ireland.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's UnitedHealthcare insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.